Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, it's the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is columnist, Albany Bureau Chief, and my personal hero lately for the New York Daily News, Ken Lovett. Welcome back, Ken.
It's good to be here.
Well, you're the man who started it all. You're the man who printed the piece months ago in which you said that this Moreland Act Commission had been compromised, basically, by the Cuomo people telling them who to subpoena and who not to subpoena and demanding that they pull some of the subpoenas back. What was that all about?
Well, exactly that. The timing of it was interesting because what we had was the Moreland, when they first got started, the Daily News, not me, but my colleagues down in the city, had a report that a housing bill had tucked inside it these tax benefits, these tax breaks for five developers, lucrative, down in the city. And we had an editorial that said, oh, the Moreland should look at this. And they started to. They sent out subpoenas. After those subpoenas went out, I had done a story that showed that the governor received hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign donations from those same developers around the time that he signed the bill. They went ballistic over the story, but they also went ballistic that the commission was going to look into this. And that's really when the interference started. And what they did was they basically told them, you know, you could send this subpoena or don't send that one. They say it was advice. But, you know, anything really with ties to the governor did not go out until we started reporting it back in September. And once we did several reports saying that they were trying to control the commission, they decided to send all the subpoenas out. In one case, one subpoena had been sent to an ad buying firm that the governor used and that the state party used to promote the governor. And the Cuomo people heard about it. Larry Schwartz, the secretary to the governor, very powerful, called the commission and said, get it back. And they rescinded it only to send it out again 3 weeks later after all the reporting came out.
Well, that's amazing. So just to put it in its proper perspective, you reported it. The commission then is influenced by journalists.
It would certainly seem that way, whether the commission or the governor's office or both. It certainly seemed they were upset. And no doubt, you had a lot of professionals on this panel. There were 25 members. Half of them almost were prosecutors, DAs. And they have reputations and credibility issues. And they didn't want to look like pawns of the governor. And there were private meetings that we reported on at the time where several had threatened to quit the panel and make their complaints public unless the governor backed off. The co-chairs of the panel brought these issues to the governor. They met with him and his aides in September. We reported that back in October, I think, and they moved off it. The Cuomo people, at least the pressure at the time, kind of subsided for a little while.
Now, one of those co-chairs, Kathleen Rice, left allegedly to run for Congress. Is there any hint she left because she was unhappy with the way the Cuomo people were acting?
No, she definitely left to run for Congress. But the second she ran for Congress, knowing how much money she was going to raise, knowing that she was going to embark on the same fundraising tactics that the commission was criticizing, she quit literally the same night that she announced that she was running for Congress. And they said, well, she's just going to be so busy. Yet she did keep her position as the president of the State District Attorneys Association. She was not happy with the interference. She was not happy with the hits she was taking publicly for her own fundraising, for her own use of the system that she was criticizing as corrupt, and she couldn't get off it fast enough.
Yeah. So now Rob Astorino is running against the governor and has used the M word, basically, and said that these are mafia-like tactics that have been shown here. Is that stupid or what?
Well, it got him publicity.
It did, which he needed desperately.
He also got a lot of criticism from Italian groups. You know, that's a sensitive subject, especially when you're talking about an Italian governor whose father had once said there was no mafia. You're talking about Andrew Cuomo, who once, when he was running in 2002 for governor in the primary, polled whether The Sopranos was offensive. So it's certainly not an issue that is a good one to bring up. He took heat for it. But the truth is, you know, Astorino's point was you had a guy who promised an independent commission and was just sitting there controlling it. You know, that was his bottom line point. He probably could have phrased it a little more tactfully, but that's really what he was saying.
So everybody wants to know from me, and I want to know from you, what does this mean to Andrew Cuomo? I mean, what's the fallout?
Well, at the very least, it's a huge embarrassment. This is a guy who, after the scandals of Elliot Spitzer, after the scandals of David Patterson, came in on a white horse, opened his campaign in front of the Tweed Courthouse in New York City, promising to clean up Albany, and came in as a white knight. And really, for the first 3 years, had a great 3 years and had very little controversy, a little bit, but not more than you would expect of any governor. And now this really takes, as someone said to me, for a guy who likes to wrap himself up in the ethics mantle, it takes it away from him. It's hard for him now to get on his high horse on this issue. That's at the very least, that he looks like a hypocrite, that he said it would be independent, and it wasn't. But
into all of this comes The Daily Show.
And The Daily Show, which I think was actually, other than the New York Times story last week, The Daily Show was the most devastating
thing. I think
thing
more so, and I'll tell you why.
Well, to me, it just goes to the mainstream.
Well, it goes to half the kids in America say the only thing they listen to for news is The Daily Show.
Exactly. And I wrote in my column on Monday, it took it from the political chattering classes to the, you know, basically national audience. And, you know, it's been all over the TV. But, you know, as I said before, the least is this hurts his image. At worst, you have a very aggressive Elliot Ness-like federal prosecutor, Preparara, looking into this matter. And if there's any indictments or anything like that, which, you know, at this moment, people don't necessarily expect, but you never know. We don't know what all the evidence is. Then that would be hugely damaging to them.
Now, Barrara has convened a grand jury, as you indicate, and grand juries can just start to bring people in under oath and ask them what they knew and when they knew it, right?
Exactly. And that was supposed to start on Monday when he was supposed to bring in the assistant to the executive director of the Moreland Commission. The executive director is Regina Calcaterra, who was appointed and put there by Governor Cuomo.
So I want to talk to you about that. It seems that within the Moreland Act Commission, there was an executive director who was appointed by the Cuomo people, who clearly had close ties to the Cuomo people. Then there was a chief investigator. What are the differences?
Well, the executive director, you know, basically dealt with the issues internally, dealt with, you know, management of the commission. The chief investigator was supposed to, you know, carry out the orders and do the investigation, the actual investigation. The chief investigator was Danya Perry. Regina Calcaterra was not trusted by the commission. They felt that she was a plant, that anything they said or did went directly back to the Cuomo administration. Danya Perry felt her hands were being tied. She was the chief investigator by Regina Calcaterra, and the two of them did not get along at all. Danya Perry quit in February, frustrated that, fed up with the interference from the Cuomo administration. So she quit and oddly took a job with Steve Cohn, who is Cuomo's former chief of staff and still one of his closest advisors.
You know, when I read that, I was fascinated by that. Steve Cohn is a brilliant man.
Yes.
He got out from under the Cuomo administration to go make money and do his thing. In politics, I don't know how to phrase this question, but sometimes if somebody quits and you're a little bit worried about what they may say or do, you find them a safe landing.
Well, certainly that's been suggested. You know, to be fair, Steve Cohn and Danya Perry go back. Both worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. You know, they've had an association for a long time. So, but certainly that raised eyebrows as a possibility. The same way Regina Calcaterra, you know, the governor pulled the plug on the commission at the end of March. And Regina Calcaterra, now here almost in August, is still on the payroll, $175,000 a year, and supposedly is still winding down the commission, even though there's no more files, there's no more laptops, and people are wondering why she's still there.
Into all of this comes Papa, Mario Cuomo. Now, Mario Cuomo has been assiduous about staying away, not hogging the limelight from his son. He comes out and he makes a series of extraordinary statements, one of which is that his son is better than he is.
Yes, he said, my boy's a good boy. He basically told the Daily News' Annie Carney that, you know, he's ethical, he's honest, meaning Andrew Cuomo, and that I wish I was as good a person as he is.
But the downside of that is, if Mario hasn't been saying anything really about Andrew. The idea that you would, that he would come out and make this impassioned defense, could it demonstrate some desperation on the part of the Andrew Cuomo camp?
Certainly, Mario Cuomo's name still carries a great weight in the state. People, even if you didn't like him 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people have a fondness for him. They feel he was ethical. They feel he was an intellectual. They feel he was an honest governor. So I don't think it hurts the governor. I don't think it's a game changer, but they're doing everything they can. And they not only had, you know, Cuomo, Mario Cuomo wasn't the only one out there, but you also had Bill Fitzpatrick, the co-chair of the commission, and three other commissioners put out statements basically saying we weren't interfered with. I thought it was an interesting tack, though. The governor, who was in hiding for 5 days, finally is set to emerge in Buffalo, as far as you can get from the New York City and Albany
Without
press
being
corps,
in Cleveland.
Without being in Cleveland. And 2 hours before the governor does his thing, Bill Fitzpatrick puts out a statement saying, no, the governor didn't interfere. You know, they gave advice. That's fine. But we were independent. We did our own thing. And the governor then leaned heavily on that statement during his, you know, 40-minute question and answer session with the reporters. I just find it interesting. What better way to say that there was no coordination between the governor's office and the Moreland Commission than to coordinate seemingly a response, although they deny it was coordinated?
Well, Ken Lovett, part of Andrew Cuomo's persona, I mean, everybody around Albany knows it, is that he can be very tough and people are scared of him. I've often thought when somebody's tough and people are scared of him, that, you know, people will act accordingly. They won't mess. But that when you've got this era of bad feelings, when something happens, that's when people really get at you.
They pounce.
Yeah.
They pounce. And that's what's happening here. I think people were kind of waiting for something for 3 years. You know, the governor has really run roughshod. And to his credit, he's kind of being hoisted on his own petard here, you know, with something that he used so effectively, which is he, for 3 years, really used the balance of fear and you know, the carrot and the stick approach, basically, to get the legislature to go along with gay marriage, to get the legislature to adopt on-time budgets, to get the legislature to adopt a gun control law. Those were all successes. But that same need for control is what was his downfall with the Moreland Commission. He couldn't keep his hands off the panel, and that's what ultimately is hurting him here, basically his control freak nature.
Yeah. There's a character who emerges, probably should be a cartoon character, called Tough Guy Andy. You know, and when somebody's tough in a situation in the schoolyard or things, people give him wide berth. But once they get damaged a little, then you don't know what starts to come out. Listen, we think he's going to go into this campaign with $50 million. Yeah. It's a lot of money. And there's a truth in politics. People give you money because they want something. Now, that's where politicians get into trouble, because if there is an established quid pro quo, you want this, you give me money, I give you this, then unless you say it into a microphone, you know, you're okay. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be a lot of stuff to be looked at now.
There is. And I think that, look, I honestly don't think that the governor wanted this commission to investigate the legislature.
Yes, a very important point. I think it was great.
He wanted the public to think the commission, and he wanted the lawmakers to think he wanted the commission to investigate.
Which they did.
Which they did. But what he really wanted was to use this as a weapon to get them to
get
give
something.
Him some kind of ethics reform. And I think he thought the threat of it would work. When it didn't, and after 3 years of threatening that we're going to do this tomorrow, and he finally, you know, had to call his own bluff, so he did it. But even then, I think he was hoping. He kept basically telling them, just give me an ethics
give
package
me something.
And it'll go away.
Give me something.
And, you know, we all look at the subpoenas that were held back that were to entities to the governor. But what I found interesting, and it was something I wrote about in September that didn't get as much focus, and, you know, deservedly so, because everyone was focused on the governor's stuff, but he also stopped, or his people also stopped, a subpoena that was going to go to both the state and the legislative ethics committees looking for all complaints in the prior 5 years that were filed about lawmakers. That would have been war with the lawmakers. And what did the governor do? His people said, no, you really shouldn't send that out. And it didn't get sent out, which tells me that, you know, he didn't want a full investigation. Then when the commission asked nicely with a letter saying, we want all your information, lawmakers, on your outside income, and the lawmakers basically told them to pound salt, the commission was ready to just, you know, straight them with here you go. Here's a bunch of subpoenas. Now you have to answer. And the governor again intervened his people and said, why don't we hold off for a couple of weeks to see if we can now negotiate an ethics package?
So they got an ethics package, but it wasn't a good ethics package. Why not?
Well, it wasn't a terrible one, but it wasn't what the governor had been seeking and what he had said he wanted.
Well, what's the difference between what he got and what he wanted?
Well, what he did get was an independent, supposedly, we'll see, investigator at the Board of Elections. A lot of the problems happened to be with campaign finance issues. He did get an independent investigative panel at the Board of Elections.
And let's see who they pick and what they do.
Right. But what he didn't get was all the stuff that would have impacted him mostly. They didn't lower contribution limits. They didn't close the loopholes that allow you to skirt those contribution limits. That's all stuff that he takes advantage more than anybody.
Wait, Ken Lovett, exactly. Now you've just gone and said it, just where I wanted to be. Here's a guy who's going to go into an election with $50 million. You telling me he really wanted that kind of reform?
No, and that's the reform he didn't get. Amazingly, huh? He settled for another package that didn't get the stuff that impacted him. So, you know, I think really, when we look back, my guess is even if he's serves two terms, three terms, when we look back, we will see, I really believe, the turning point in the administration was his naming the commission in the first place, because I think that's what brought him down from the stratosphere in a lot of ways, and that's what...
I couldn't understand it when he did it. Ken Lovett, you deserve a Pulitzer Prize for this. But before we go on, I want to ask you about something we haven't heard much about lately, and I ask you to keep the answer terse because we only have 8 minutes left, but the IDC, the Independent Democratic Conference, these are the guys who made love to the Republicans, if for want of a better word.
Ugly image, but
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, well, maybe. They say they're coming over to the Democratic side, but only as partners, not as part of the conference, right?
Right. Basically, changing dance partners. You know, right now they're in a coalition where they have their own little conference of five people. The Republicans have theirs, and then they have co-leaders in Jeff Klein and Dean Skelos, and they run the chamber jointly. Instead of running the chamber jointly with the Republicans, if there are enough Democrats in the chamber, then it'll be the IDC and the Democrats.
But they never
chamber.
Did run the chamber jointly with the Republicans. That's what they said for the press releases. But in fact, Skelos, the Republican leader, was still running things.
He ran a lot. No, but the IDC had gotten some stuff that they might not have otherwise. Look, Klein certainly held out for a minimum wage hike last year. You know, a lot of people weren't happy with the result, but, you know, that wouldn't have happened at all without him. I think there's a bunch of issues that you could say Klein needed. I think Skelos recognized that they had to give Klein some things. Now, the big stuff that really got them in trouble, you know, he wasn't going to budge on campaign finance, wasn't going to budge on the DREAM Act, wasn't going to budge on a bunch of that kind of stuff. But no, Klein got some stuff. And, you know, the key to this thing was that both leaders were able to keep legislation from coming to the floor. So Skelos could keep progressive, but, you know, Klein, I'm sure, kept stuff from coming to the floor as well.
Can you name one?
Well, I can't give you a specific.
Okay,
no, but I do know toward the end of session, we saw fewer bills pass the Senate. That's because they couldn't get it to the floor.
Yeah. Now, I see that Andrew Cuomo has now endorsed Klein against his primary opponent, Ali Coppell. What do you make of that?
Well, it's not a surprise. That was part of the agreement when, Cuomo was going for the Working Families Party. He promised to unify the Democrats in the Senate. And one thing he said was, if the IDC doesn't come back into the fold, then they will all face primaries. Once they came back to the fold, there was agreement that the establishment wouldn't support the primary, especially Oliver Coppell's primary.
Okay. There's a woman named Zephyr Teachout, my favorite name of all. And she's running against Cuomo in a primary. She was the one who the Working Families Party was looking to nominate as their gubernatorial candidate. In comes Bill de Blasio, saves Cuomo's hash, and Zephyr Teachout is still on the primary ballot. She did 45,000 or something like that petitions, which got her on there. I'm hearing that she told me that the Cuomo people want to get her disqualified.
Yeah, I think they've given up on the idea of getting rid of her petitions. I mean, there's just so many signatures. You need 15,000, she got 45. But they are challenging her residency. To run for governor, you have to have lived in the state for 5 years. They're challenging that. She says that she became a professor at Fordham in 2009, and that would make it. She admits she lives a lot of the time in Vermont, especially in the summers. But we'll see what the courts say.
Well, yeah, because it first goes to the Board of Elections, right? And Cuomo has people there, let's put it that way. And then it'll be contested in the courts, right?
Right, exactly. And interestingly enough, they did not challenge the candidacy, who's a fringe candidate as well, but Randy Credico, who was a comedian and an activist, and they didn't challenge that. And you think, well, why would they challenge Teach Out? I think Teach Out, they feel, would have a lot more support within the progressive community.
Oh, absolutely.
But also, by allowing Credico, who they don't see as a threat at all, to remain on the ballot, Andrew Cuomo gets to keep and raise more money. Because when you run a primary, you get to get about 17,000, 18,000 more per donor than you would if you didn't have a primary.
So Cuomo goes out, and he has Kathy Hochul, his lieutenant governor candidate, announce a women's equality line. Up to then, nobody knew who Kathy Hochul was, and she's from the Niagara region. So what was that all about?
Well, I think it's giving her an issue. Look, Kathy Hochul is a conservative Democrat, or has been. She was a congresswoman and the Erie County clerk. And
she's evolving.
She is evolving like so many have, like Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yes.
But this was a woman who was Erie County clerk, said she would fight and not honor the law if Spitzer got passed that would allow illegal immigrants to get driver's licenses. She's also had a perfect record from the NRA. So these are things that certainly didn't play well, particularly in the liberal parts of the state, New York City, and some of the inner cities. So they gave her an issue that certainly plays well among progressives and women, and that is the Women's Equality Party.
Now, what about this idea that you know, you get the signatures, you can put as many parties on the line, you know, the Women's Equality Party, the this, the that. I mean, some states don't allow that.
No, New York's one of the only ones. And, you know, most states don't allow, and I think New York is either one or two of the only states that allow fusion voting, which is where you can get the nomination from minor parties and be a major party candidate. It's probably part of the problem in the eyes of a lot of people with our electoral system here in the state.
And why is it a problem again?
Well, because you're going for votes. You're trying to win parties. You saw the governor basically, you know, put over a barrel to get the Working Families Party nomination. You know, there are a lot of people who believe if you're a Democratic candidate, you should run as a Democrat. And if you feel you need a Working Families Party, they should have their own candidate.
So,
because people buy into the lines. Look at the Independence Party, which has been accused of basically, you know, being paid off for candidates.
How are Bill de Blasio and Governor Cuomo getting along these days?
These days, okay. They're pretty good right now. Yeah. Don't forget, the mayor really bailed the governor out with the Working Families Party. The mayor
is he owed big time?
Is a real progressive. Is he owed big time? Yes, he's owed big time. The only, you know, will he pay it back? We don't know.
Yeah. And we see that Mr. Rapfogel has pled guilty, is going to jail for 3.5 years.
To
10 years. And, you know, kids who walk into grocery stores with a gun get longer than that. So is this sort of taking care of business?
Well, I mean, look, 3 1/3 to 10 is not anything to sneeze at. He did pilfer $9 million from a charity. He kept $1 million of it of himself.
Very good friend of Sheldon Silver. Not Sheldon E.
Yeah. The speaker, Sheldon Silver, and Rapfogel's wife is Sheldon Silver's chief of staff. There's no indications, according to law enforcement, that either the speaker or Judy Rapfogel knew of anything. They're not charged with anything. But, you know, it's a sad situation. This was a prominent man who, along with several others, engaged in a major fraud to a very important charity in the city and now is going to do the time.
Yeah, you often wonder, at least I do, I'm sure in your reportage you do too, how these guys could be so stupid.
Yeah, especially, you know, we've seen such dumb incidents. You know, we saw a lawmaker go to prison because he accepted $20,000 in bribes. And in the scheme of things, $20,000 to put you in prison is nothing, particularly with how loose the New York campaign finance laws are. You could have just had them donate and use the money any way you want, practically anyway.
So you're riding.
Which I'm not encouraging.
No, of course not. You're riding the whirlwind, Ken Lovett. You started the top story on everybody's lips. How does that feel?
Look, it's I feel good. You know, I mean, in terms of, it's an important story. It's one I'm glad we were able to tell and we really pushed hard on over the last couple of months, and it's bearing fruit.
We are out of time. Our guest has been columnist and Albany bureau chief for the New York Daily News, Ken Lovett. Ken, thanks so much for joining us today.
Anytime. Be well.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.